do you think a project like Pebble or Sioux Sittenham would be possible if this went through?
No, we don't think so. That's basically the crux of our case.
An appeals court judge will decide whether a salmon protection ballot initiative can proceed. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage Police Department focuses more resources on property and violent crime.
The department suffered from low staffing for a while, and I think whenever you don't have law enforcement pressure on criminal activity, it tends to increase.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Last month, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott rejected a potential ballot measure that would strengthen state law protecting salmon habitat. The state's position is that it would be forced to protect salmon over all its other resources. The people who wrote the ballot measure appealed. Now a Superior Court judge has to decide whether the Lieutenant Governor was right. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Harbaugh reports on why this initiative is pitting private industry against environmentalists.
The key question at the hearing was this: does the ballot initiative give the state enough wiggle room to decide whether projects like the proposed Pebble Mine or Sioux Sittenham Dam can move forward if they impact salmon streams? Last month, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott decided it doesn't and rejected the initiative. The state's argument is that the initiative would violate the Constitution by forcing the legislature to prioritize salmon habitat over other natural resource development. Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Bacalar says megaprojects like the Pebble Mine proposal could be at stake.
Do you think a project like Pebble or Sioux Sittenham would be possible if this went through?
No, we don't think so. That's basically the crux of our case.
But the attorney for the nonprofit Stand for Salmon, the group behind the initiative, argued the opposite. Valerie Brown with Trustees for Alaska says the language in the initiative does toughen regulations, but it doesn't force the state to shut projects down.
This sets up a system where really big projects that will cause a lot of harm to salmon habitat get increased scrutiny.
Many Alaska industry groups came out in force against the ballot initiative. Marliana Hall is executive director of the Resource Development Council. Hall says current law does enough to protect salmon habitat.
We truly believe that it was a disproportionate response to a problem that doesn't exist.
Hall says the new language could effectively halt a wide range of projects, from oil fields to roads. Two of the initiative's organizers are outspoken opponents of the proposed Pebble Mine, and a third, Mike Wood, has led efforts fighting the Sioux Sittenham Dam. But Wood, a commercial fisherman, says this initiative is not intended to halt projects. Instead, he argues that Alaska's laws protecting fish habitat are too weak.
Let's give this permit system some teeth again so that we can be ensured that when these projects are built, that they won't be impacting our fish resources.
Under current law, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game must approve projects unless they are deemed, quote, insufficient for the proper protection of fish and game, unquote. And just what is proper protection? The ballot measure lays out some specifics. It adds language about water quality, temperature, and flow. It would also set up a new permitting process for companies, one that's based on the level of impact a project might have on fish habitat. Judge Mark Ridner is expected to make a decision this week on whether voters should decide this issue at the ballot box. But that may not be the final word on this case. It's likely to be appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
This week, the Pebble Mine will begin rolling out more detailed plans for their project than ever before. The company will put a smaller design on the table that they say addresses many of the environmental concerns that have been raised in more than a decade of discussions and protest. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more on how Bristol Bay residents are getting ready to again talk about the controversial Pebble Mine.
Nathan Hill is the manager of the Lake and Peninsula Borough, which the Pebble Deposit sits inside of.
The position of the borough is neutral. We are tasked with approving permits regarding any development in the borough, and so for us to have anything but a neutral stance would not make our permitting process a fair one.
Hill is Alaska native, a BB&C shareholder, and member of his tribe. He's a lifelong commercial and subsistence fisherman who lives in Kakanak along the shores of Iliamna Lake. He knows as well as anybody the stakes involved, and depending on the success, flop, or failure of a pebble mine, the burrow he manages stands to gain or lose more than anywhere else in Bristol Bay. The burrow pulls in roughly $1.5 million in taxes from the commercial sockeye harvest each year, and will have some taxing authority over the mine if it's developed that could reap millions annually. A pebble mine might create more jobs and contracts, but there will inevitably be disruption to the way of life and potential for a wide range of environmental risk to communities in the borough. That's why Hill says he's trying to stay as informed as he can.
To ignore facts and reality, it doesn't do anything to satisfy that. And so, in my opinion, if you want to have good information, you need to be open to that information. And that's what I'm trying to do, is keep apprised of all arguments and all information and make myself available to do the job of borough manager, and that's to give the assembly and the folks that live within the borough the best information possible.
Downstream from the site, down the Coctuli to the Mulchatna to the world-famous king salmon-producing Nooshigak River, sits Dillingham, the largest hub in Bristol Bay and center of the region's loudest opposition to pebble mine.
Not having seen the plan, I will still oppose the mine. It has many ramifications that could affect the commercial fishery, the sport fishery, and the subsistence fisheries out here.
That's Robin Samuelson, a commercial fisherman, local tribal chief, and member of the BBNC and BBEDC boards of directors, amongst other hats that he wears. Word about Pebble's plans and potential partner have been trickling out for a few weeks. The company has said openly it will be putting a mine plan much smaller than ever discussed previously. Samuelson says any copper and gold mine, no matter the size, will pose too great a risk in the watershed. His answer is still no, but he is open to seeing what the company has to offer.
I think there's room for us to invite them. They don't have to invite us. We'll invite them to look at what they're planning on doing. It isn't just a hell no, but we're monitoring the situation, and I believe that the supermajority of Bristol Bay is going to continue to oppose that mine.
Pebble has a few strong supporters in the region who mainly have spoken up about the need for jobs and income that, especially around Iliamna Lake, other organizations have failed to create. But there are also more Bristol Bay residents who are open to see the mine get a full vetting through the regular permitting process, says Lisa Reimers. She's the CEO of Iliamna Development Corporation and a board member with the Iliamna Village Council, and has worked with Pebble in the past.
We've never said we're for Pebble, but people put us in that camp, and hopefully people will listen to our opinions. And if it doesn't help the shareholders or INL or the area, and there's too much risk, what are we? We really have to look at it if this is a good project for the area. We don't know.
Earlier this year, the BB&C board threatened to oust Kim Williams by a proxy recall vote if she did not resign from Pebble's advisory committee. Williams, from Dillingham, backed down, but Igiagig's Alexana Salmon did join, saying it was a difficult decision to make that has since cost her some friendships.
This Pebble project is located on state land that has been designated for mineral development, and I have no control over that property or its status, besides being a single resident voter of the state. And this is a project that's in our backyard. It would be life transforming for our community. And if there's an opportunity to be at the table to learn even a day ahead of the masses of what they're planning, I want to be at that table. And it's not for me, it's for all of the future generations.
Later this week, Pebble says they will start rolling out the details of their mine plan and its estimated impacts on the local environment and economy, a conversation the company says they will bring to the region in the months ahead. Next week, the EPA is also coming back out again, too, to see what's on the minds of folks who live at the crossroads of the world's greatest sockeye salmon fishery and one of the largest copper and gold deposits on Earth. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
as property and violent crime continue to increase in Anchorage. The city's police department is internally reorganizing to better respond. Speaking at a press conference today, Police Chief Justin Dahl says the department's expansion in recent years is allowing it to increase its focus on property, drug, and violent crime. The APD's new initiative has three main elements, all of which, Dahl says, should be fully in place later this month.
Overall, our goal here is to more effectively deal with violent offenders and run more efficient drug investigations and gather and utilize relevant intelligence. As you've listened to me talk, you've heard kind of some internal rearrangement that we're doing. What that's really meant to do is just streamline that chain of command, make us more efficient, and make sure that we don't have bureaucracy getting in the way of active investigations and operations.
Those changes include bringing officers and detectives focused on drug crime under one command, as well as expanding intelligence sharing with other law enforcement agencies and adding detectives to the homicide and robbery units. Finally, Dahl says the department is creating an entirely new unit designed to support larger investigations.
So that'll be things like helping serve search warrants, run surveillance, find witnesses, assist detectives with long-term investigations. And then when they're not doing those things, provide high-intensity patrol operations in various parts of town as we identify hotspots and crime trends.
Across Anchorage, residents, business owners, and elected officials say crime is on the rise, though explanations of the causes and the degree of increase are hotly contested. Dahl agrees there is more serious crime and says this new strategy aims to make the police department less reactive and more proactive. As for data that shows crime increasing not just in Anchorage but nationally, Dahl says there isn't a simple explanation.
I think in Anchorage we have a combination of things. The department suffered from low staffing for a while, and I think whenever you don't have law enforcement pressure on criminal activity, it tends to increase. I think that we're seeing a rise in the use of opioids, and that tends to affect property crimes because those people need to have some sort of income or something they can trade for the drugs that they need to stay not sick. So, you know, I think it's a whole host of things.
Dahl says of the 409 officers at APD today, there are still dozens in training, with another academy in December expected to further grow the force. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new report on a 2013 incident at Spring Creek Correctional Center.
This kind of behavior is not acceptable in our prison.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The state's ombudsman's office says staff at Spring Creek Correctional Center violated the law in 2013 when they stripped 12 inmates and locked them naked in cold cells without clothing, blankets, or mattresses for up to 12 hours. The ombudsman made recommendations to rectify the situation in a report released last week. The commissioner of the Department of Corrections says he's determined to prevent something like this from happening again. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman reports.
In early August of 2013, 14 inmates created a disturbance at Spring Creek by smashing toilets, windows, and sinks. They were moved to segregation. 10 days later, one of the inmates broke a shower head and tried to flood the housing unit. 12 other inmates were accused of encouraging him. They were taken from their cells and chained together, stripped in front of a female staff person, then locked naked into different cells without coverings or mattresses. Staff were not reprimanded for their actions. An inmate filed a grievance that was dismissed by the Spring Creek administrators. Those officials no longer lead the institution. The ombudsman's office found the staff's actions to be illegal, unconstitutional, and against Department of Corrections policy.
This kind of behavior is not acceptable in our prisons.
That's State Ombudsman Kate Burkhart talking about the actions of staff toward the inmates.
These individuals had previously destroyed a significant amount of property in the prison, and that doesn't justify what happened.
She says policies and procedures to protect the safety and dignity of both inmates and staff broke down. The report recommends changing policies on strip searches and the use of restraint devices. Department of Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams says they are already implementing most of those changes and are revising other DOC policies, some of which are more than 20 years old.
What happened then, by every standard that I have and I think our department leadership have, that incident was completely unacceptable.
He says he and his leadership team are pushing to change the culture of the department to prevent incidences like this in the future. Part of that strategy is to improve the relationship between inmates and staff by treating both with respect and humanity.
This whole concept isn't just for the benefit of the inmates. It's really about developing a security. It's another element of security around how you interact. Because when you have relationships with people, even the ones in your custody, they're more likely to have better interactions. So you don't have this developing sort of us versus them dynamic.
Williams also created an internal investigation unit that's independent of the institutions to look into reports like this one and to take corrective actions. The 2013 incident was investigated by the lieutenant who ordered the illegal actions. The ombudsman's report also suggests equipping corrections officers with body cameras. Williams says he's open to the idea and the accountability body cams provide to both inmates and staff, but he needs to consider how the evidence would be handled and how the policy would impact other departments. From Alaska Public Media, I'm Ann Hillman.
Cleveland Volcano in the Aleutians near Unalaska is restless. The Alaska Volcano Observatory reported yesterday that a new lava dome formed in the summit crater over the weekend, and lava is trickling out. A geophysicist with the AVO, Dave Snyder, describes the event as relatively routine. It's been about a decade, by Snyder's estimate, since Cleveland has exploded with a significant amount of lava. This pattern of building pressure and spewing small amounts of lava is one it goes through frequently.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
By next fall, the first batch of University of Alaska Southeast undergraduates are expected to begin a first-of-its-kind scholarship program for Alaska. Students that are accepted become active-duty enlisted members of the Coast Guard, receive full salary and benefits, and start a track to become fully commissioned officers upon graduation. KTOO's Adeline Baxter reports UAS and the Coast Guard on Monday signed an agreement establishing the program.
During the signing ceremony, Coast Guard Rear Admiral Michael McAllister said the partnership opens up an exchange of knowledge between the campus and the Coast Guard.
It's a great opportunity for the many, many Coast Guard men and women in Alaska, but particularly Southeast Alaska, to get engaged back in the classroom, whether they're as students, as mentors, or even guest instructors from time to time. And it's an opportunity for students here at UAS to get out and learn about some of the things that the Coast Guard does in terms of marine environmental protection, in terms of fisheries enforcement, in terms of search and rescue, and give them experiential type learning out in the field, as it were.
Students must be full-time sophomores or juniors in order to apply to the College Student Pre-Commissioning Initiative, or CSPI, for their junior and senior years. Much like ROTC, students accepted into the program are on track to become fully commissioned officers upon graduation. They also receive up to 2 years full tuition. Unlike ROTC, CSPI students are active duty enlisted members of the Coast Guard and receive full salary and benefits. Lieutenant Junior Grade Colin McClellan graduated from the CSPI program at Norfolk State University more than a year ago and is now assigned to Juneau. McClellan comes from 5 generations of military service, so being involved in a tight-knit community was a major factor in his decision to join.
Being a part of the Coast Guard in an area like this is something to be proud of and something that definitely makes you go home, go to sleep at night, and you feel like you did something.
UAS Chancellor Rick Caulfield signed the agreement with McAllister. and said the campus has plans to create a scholarship for freshmen and sophomore students who plan to enroll in C-SPY.
Juneau has a great marine industry, and the more we can educate young people about all aspects of the maritime industry here, whether it's joining the Coast Guard or getting involved with the fishing industry or marine repair, it gives students an idea of how they can make a living in this beautiful setting that we're in and how important maritime industry is to our economy here in Juneau.
Applications for the first C-SPY class at UAS will be due in January. In Juneau, I'm Madeline Baxter.
The man at the center of a lawsuit over National Park Service authority to regulate rivers in Alaska parks is reacting to the most recent legal decision in the case. A three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision Monday in the long-running case filed by Anchorage hunter John Sturgeon. Sturgeon contested a National Park Service ban on hovercraft use within Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve in the eastern interior. The case reached the U.S. Supreme Court, which remanded it back to the Ninth Circuit in March. The appeals court again backed Park Service authority. Sturgeon points to a disconnect between the two courts.
Supreme Court said over and over again, Alaska is different by law, that our laws are different, that our parks, preserves, and refuges are supposed to be managed differently than the lower 48.
The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, that established Yukon Charley Preserve and many other federal parks in Alaska, allows NPS system-wide regulations, like the hovercraft ban, to be applied inside Alaska parks. But Sturgeon maintains non-federal inholdings, like state-owned rivers, are not included.
The federal government should not have control over state-owned navigable waters. I think that's the bottom line.
The environmental law firm Trustees for Alaska sided with the Park Service in the Sturgeon case. Attorney Katie Strong says this week's ruling clarifies a difference between river waters and other park inholdings like state and Alaska Native lands, which are immune from NPS regulations.
Waterways flowing through the parks are public lands, and they are to be regulated by the Park Service to protect the parks as Congress intended when establishing them.
The Sturgeon case and the broader fight over control of Alaska rivers may not be over. Sturgeon says he's considering another appeal, noting that his case is backed by the state, numerous groups, and many Alaskans. Climate change is thawing the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's permafrost, and it's doing more than cracking foundations, sinking roads, and accelerating erosion. In some villages, it is turning cemeteries into swamps. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports.
On a crisp day in September, the village of Kongiganak, also known as Kong, files into a little white church and lays Maggie Mary Otto to rest. This service is crowded. Mrs. Otto was beloved. An elder and de facto marriage counselor, she was the kind of person who cooked steaming plates of walrus for her community every January for a Russian Orthodox Christmas, even though she wasn't Orthodox herself. After the viewing, Maggie Mary Otto's pallbearers carry her casket outside. They place it on a metal cart and attach it to the back of a four-wheeler. Kong Cemetery is a 10-minute drive on a boardwalk over marshy tundra. A procession of four-wheelers follows the casket. A rust-colored hill, a smattering of chalk-white crosses. After the prayer, rather than lowering Mrs. Otto's body into the ground, pallbearers place her casket on a low wooden platform, raised about 6 inches above the ground on blocks. A half dozen men lift a white wooden box and place it over her casket to protect it from the elements, covering it completely. The community has stopped burying its dead because as the permafrost melts, the oldest part of their cemetery is sinking, and digging graves in the soggy ground was just making it worse.
After we dug down 6 feet, most of them, it created a lake around it.
Roland Andrew, Kong's tribal administrator, guides me through the cemetery. The white crosses stick out of the sunken ground at odd angles, some of them almost completely submerged in the brackish water. The swamp appeared here 10 or 15 years ago and then expanded, swallowing the graves around it.
There were some bones, so He put a tire ground from the lowland area.
The graveyard in the neighboring village of Quigilingok, also known as Quig, is also sinking into swampland. After consulting with Quig's elders for advice, Andrew says Kong started laying its loved ones to rest in boxes above ground. Digging into the ground removes the plants and topsoil that insulate the permafrost and accelerates the rising water. Andrew says that the swamp stopped expanding when Kong stopped burying its dead, but a row of white grave boxes from about a decade ago are teetering at odd angles, sliding feet first into the lake. The water is still causing problems. Back in town at Mrs. Otto's funeral feast in an old high school gym, plates are piled high with seal stew and a gudok, while children wrestle each other by the bleachers. Mrs. Otto's daughter, Betty Phillip, sits quietly in a corner. She's happy they've laid her mother to rest on higher ground. Not all of her family is so lucky.
Her dad and my grandpa, he's one of them that's under the water.
If she wears rubber boots that reach above her knees, Philip says, she can wade in close to his grave, but can't quite touch his cross. Others tell similar stories. One man says that his cousins tried to drain the water from around the grave of his grandparents. When they were alive, they held the family together. His cousins didn't have much luck. Another woman, Hannah Jimmy, says her parents, her aunts, her uncles, her sister, and her best friend are all in the cemetery, buried together in a single row. They're underwater now.
We're so poor, we can't even do nothing about it.
Tribal administrator Roland Andrew says the village is trying to move the sunken graves to higher ground, but they don't have the money yet. He says that thawing permafrost is warping Kong in other ways. The river is eroding the shoreline. And then there's the fact that Kong is sinking. The hill the village stands on is slowly slipping to sea level.
Do you think that Kong would ever need to be relocated because of climate change?
Like I said, this hill used to be high. And still going down.
Andrew says he doesn't see moving the village. If anything, he says Kong might double in size. People in the nearby village of Quig are talking about moving here because of the coastal storms. Andrew wants to be buried next to his parents. He keeps a picture of them above his desk. They died last year within 8 months of each other after being married for over 60 years. Their graves are among the newest. Their boxes still smell like fresh paint and are wreathed in plastic flowers, propped up on blocks in the cemetery's highest ground. For now. For KYUK, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis in Kongiganak.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harball, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dave Benninger and Avery Lill in Dillingham, Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Teresa Kotsarilis in Kungiganuk. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.